Well, one of the main characters in Kathleen Ernst's book was a historical gardener in her book of fiction, set at Old World Wisconsin. And now I have in front of me the real thing, the real person. Marcia Carmichael is the historical gardener at the 576-acre Old World Wisconsin site, where she exercises her passion for historical accuracy and enjoys the research as much as the design, creation, and nurturing of the museum's many heritage gardens. And she supervises and works alongside a very dedicated group of historical garden volunteers to create period-appropriate, I guess would be the way to say it, period-appropriate gardens. And she appreciates all aspects of heirloom plants, from propagation to harvest and from folklore to fact. And she's put this together in a very engaging book. It's titled Putting Down Roots, Gardening Insights from Wisconsin's Early Settlers. And it's a Wisconsin Historical Society book. And it is fabulous book. I'm telling you, the photography and the writing is absolutely wonderful. And I really, it was a lot of fun for us to first read Kathleen's book and then turn to Marcia's book for kind of, in a way, the real thing here. And so it's a great pleasure for me to have her with us today. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. Do you intentionally grow older varieties of vegetables or flowers? Do you grow certain things that are a tie to your ethnic background? Love to hear from you. Or maybe you have some questions about your own ethnic background and the kinds of crops and the kinds of things that happened to people back in the 1850s or 1860s. Well, tell you what, Marcia can help out. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a comment or a question there. We also have a link to Marcia's book as well at the website. And Marcia, thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you so much, Larry.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. And you look at several types of gardens and groups and the groups of people who tended them. And what's the time range for the gardens at Old World?
Well, at Old World, we range from a Norwegian garden in 1845 and take it all the way through a Finnish garden in 1915. So we cover quite a few years, and some of the ethnicities have more than one time period. So we have 12 different ethnic gardens there.
Ah, it must be so much fun to work in those gardens.
It's the best. The scenery is wonderful. Yeah, there's nothing better, I think.
Well, and you, and describe how you've got your book organized here.
We wanted to get in touch with the wonderful ethnic diversity that Wisconsin has throughout history. So many different people have come to this state, and it's very exciting to be able to sort of showcase the strengths and the character of each ethnic group. And we talk a little bit about their style of gardening, the plants that they grew in their homeland, the plants that they grew in America and Wisconsin, the way they planted them, you know, the style, the layout of the garden. And then we go into some typical recipes that each ethnic group had enjoyed, tried to do a nice variation, so possibly bread and soup, and obviously vegetable things from the gardens, different garden produce, main dishes, and then something for sweet, because that's, for me personally, I have quite a sweet tooth, and I really, for some ethnic groups, have to look a little harder for the dessert, but I wanted something in there for sweet. So if you really wanted to, you could do a complete meal out of the book, but it's more talking about the history and typical means of preparation for the dishes and things that were common and were sort of comfort foods to people.
And I love the sidebar stories, too. You have many little sidebars. The garden engine was one that really that I was really interested in, because it's called the garden engine, but it's a watering
Yeah, it's a watering device. Isn't it fabulous? And the sidebars that concern material culture or the implements that we use in the gardens were written by our curator of collections, Ellen Penwell. And she supplies me with, if I put something on the wish list, and she has volunteers who can help make those happen. And we use a lot of reproduction tools, and this garden engine is fantastic. It was one of those things I had read about, seen it in a catalog, a 19th century catalog, and I thought, we need to look into this. And we scoured far and wide, and we could find them listed in the old catalogs, but couldn't find one in existence. So, of course, there presents the challenge. I think we need one. We got a grant, a gift from the Herb Society of America Wisconsin unit, and we had at it. We put our heads together. We took the magnifying glass out, looked at all the old images, sent to England for some catalogs, and our wonderful woodworking genius has created this fabulous, and now people can come out and they can crank this garden engine and help us water the 1860 Yankee garden.
It is absolutely fabulous. And I have to say as well, and Rob, we'll get to you in just a second here from Madison, but I have to say that the photography in the book is just outstanding.
Oh, thank you. I worked with the most wonderful, dedicated group of volunteer photographers who have, you know, given these pictures for us to use in the book, that they were on call. So if I had a garden that was going to look good for, you know, X number of days, I said, you know, this is our target. Please come out. They were adamant about getting, you know, early morning light or late evening light or whatever. We had a lot of discussions about what the lighting should be and how each plant, each garden should look its best in order to support the text. So they were a gift from a total gift.
Just absolutely marvelous photography.
Thank you. And
to go along with a great writing as well.
Thank you.
Rob and Madison, we'll turn to you. Rob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for taking the call. And I was wondering if your guest might comment a little bit on helping me search out some things I might plant and grow to deal with Welsh heritage. I have a Welsh background, and I'm curious if there's anything that will grow here that would be part of that that tradition.
Certainly all of the early settlers relied heavily on root crops, and you're always safe with the basics, potatoes, turnips, onions, usually beets and carrots as well. All of the British Isles, folks from the British Isles were a little suspicious early on about eating things in the raw, so they mostly had cooked vegetables. They weren't as big on salads, but I would think if you look at, we do have a section in our book about the Yankees, and those are people who had origins in the British Isles originally and then came to America. I think you'll find some interesting insights into what the Welsh as well as other people from the British Isles were doing at the time. Lots of good things you can put in your garden. And the Yankees were certainly progressive and they're looking forward to how they were going to improve the world. And I'm thinking maybe I need a trip to Wales to do a little more research for you.
That might be nice. Go to Aberystwyth if you've never been in that area. It's absolutely beautiful.
Oh, the countryside there is just incredibly beautiful. Yes,
yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. We would love to hear from you. We have a lot of Facebook questions. Mary Beth wonders, where did we get our rhubarb from? Mine is from my grandpa's farm. He would now be 125 if he was alive, and likely he and my grandmother got theirs from their parents. But where did the immigrants from Scandinavia get theirs originally?
I think they found it probably in America when they came here. It did come early on with settlers. Originated, I believe, in China, and it has been here. I know the Germans didn't bring it with them, but they found it and adapted to it. It was one of those crops that has done extremely well in Wisconsin. That's why we can have grandma's and great-grandma's rhubarb. A lot of different varieties were available in the 19th century, so they were obviously selecting for different traits. It's not that everybody had the great big old fat green ones. There were descriptions of, even as early as 1863, of thin red ones, all different types of rhubarb. It was a plant, it was called pie plant often in the research, and it was considered fairly, although it grew really easily, it was fairly expensive to process because in order to make it into a pie, it required quite a bit of sugar, and sugar was expensive. So it's one of those sort of specialty things. You could grow it, but it was sort of a special treat to have a pie or sauce made out of it.
I wonder if anybody ever used something like maple syrup.
Absolutely, yes.
To substitute?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I would think. Another Facebook question, when did we in the northern U.S. start growing tomatoes? I know they were feared to be poisonous in a much earlier time, and our modern... Here's another question. Are modern squash or corn varieties derived from some that had been bred by Native Americans?
That's true. A lot of New World crops came with the Native Americans and then were found by the various European ethnic groups when they settled in Wisconsin. Tomatoes were viewed suspiciously because they were indeed thought to be poisonous by some of the really earlier people. The Yankees were the first ones to decide that it was probably more than just a pretty face to grow in the garden, but something that you could enjoy eating, and they found them safe. And so they were written about in the gardening books in the 1860s. We find that the Germans and Scandinavians weren't necessarily including them in their gardens that early. I think they looked across at the Yankee neighbors with a little suspicion on were those actually safe to eat. And in our three German gardens at Old World, Wisconsin, we only include tomatoes in the 1880 garden, the most modern one of the three, because the research shows that it took a number of years for a lot of the people to take a look at and trust that tomatoes could be eaten. Also, different parts of the state, of course. The further north you went, the less likely you were to produce a decent crop. So those who lived in the south maybe tried them a little bit earlier.
And Yankee settler gardens are the first ones you actually look at in your book. You mentioned them. And their gardens were, what type of gardens did they grow?
Well, they were some of the first people to come into the Wisconsin area and picked up some really choice land and had the availability of a wide variety of things. So by the time the railroad came through in the mid-1800s, seeds could be ordered, plants could be carried across the country. Lots of things were available. So they were reading and writing and experimenting with a lot of different plants. Not sure they were cooking with quite as many as they were growing. So they had the opportunity to grow a lot of things, but they tended to not be super adventurous maybe in their cooking.
Marcia Carmichael, our guest today, author of Putting Down Roots, Gardening Insights from Wisconsin's Early Settlers. She'll be with us until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're a gardener, do you ever stop to think about why you grow what you do and whether your ethnic background plays a role? Do you tend to maybe toward root vegetables? Maybe there's horseradish somewhere in the garden? Or basil, tomatoes, peppers, do they dominate? Hi, Larry Mueller here. So glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. Marcia Carmichael is the historical gardener at Old World Wisconsin Living History Museum. She's the author of a new book, Putting Down Roots, Gardening Insights from Wisconsin's Early Settlers. She's with us until 12:30. Happy to answer your questions when you call in. That number, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org and post a comment, question, or a photo on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Like the page while you're there, and we'll give you updates on upcoming shows. Back after the news. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're talking today with Marcia Carmichael, historical gardener at the 576-acre Old World, Wisconsin. And there she exercises her passion for history and for gardening. And she's put it all together in a book titled Putting Down Roots, Gardening Insights from Wisconsin's Early Settlers. A wonderful book. Great to have her with us today to talk about the gardens at Old World, Wisconsin. And I'm telling you, the photography and the writing is just outstanding. It's great to have her here, and thank you for listening in. And maybe you have a question about some of the older varieties of vegetables and flowers as well. Do you grow certain things that are tied to your ethnic background, or have some general questions about them or about Old World Wisconsin itself? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can join us there. And Marcia, you brought me a bouquet, and it smells so good.
I brought you an assortment of things that I cut from the gardens at Old World, Wisconsin. So everything's edible in there. If you would choose to eat them, I know that you eat, I know that you garden. Uh-huh. And I thought maybe you'd enjoy some of those.
Well, it's just absolutely beautiful. Thank you so much for bringing them. And how many varieties? I mean, do you have an idea of how many varieties you grow in the various gardens?
I haven't counted. We do a tremendous variety, lots of different varieties of, you know, particular things, and mm-hmm. then just a wide expanse. And every year we change up a little bit. So as I do more research and I find certain things that I can add to the gardens, we do all of that. Every garden has some representation of herbs in them, as well as if they traditionally had flowers in them, we add a little bit of flowers for brightness, and then lots of good basic produce for eating.
And each you've got several sections within your book, and so each section takes a different ethnic group, and then with great photography of the gardens that you and the buildings that you've established that relate to each of these groups. And that's wonderful. And I enjoyed the history. You know, you were writing about the Irish in there and saying that a man, an Irishman, would eat 14 pounds of potatoes in a day.
Yeah, they put all their eggs in one basket. They really, really ate lots and lots of potatoes, so that when the disease hit in Ireland and knocked the potatoes down, they really weren't quite sure what they could be eating, because they'd given up on so many of the other crops they previously had eaten. So they were used to, you know, 1,001 ways to fix potatoes, I guess, although generally they boiled them and just ate meal after meal of potatoes.
And I'm trying to think now. I'm forgetting the ethnic group, but there was a lot of planning that went into those home gardens. And I know people, one ethnic group, figured about 100 heads of cabbage, I assume, is made German.
That would be those Germans and their sauerkraut, yes.
Yeah, so 100 heads of cabbage per family member.
That's right. So the cabbage and the potatoes also they grew in large quantities, and those they grew with the field crops rather than in the kitchen garden, so that then the farmer, the husband, could tend to those in large quantities, and then the lady of the house could deal with all of the rest of the crops that were grown, which would include plants for medicine and for dye. They grew flax for linen, and sometimes raised sheep for wool, and then dyed those fibers so that they'd mm-hmm. have some great color. Besides food and fragrance and all those other wonderful things.
Yeah, absolutely. And the gardens, early on, the gardens were in the front of the house, sort of like where our front lawn would be.
That's right. So again, the German tradition was can be dated back well over 1,000 years to the early medieval monasteries. And this was, you know, back Charlemagne was making lists of what plants should be grown in the gardens. And the German peasant garden had traditionally had continued on with the same selection of plants. They, you know, they certainly added mm-hmm. a few new ones as it went along, but they dictated that these gardens would be laid out geometrically in these very neat rectangular beds. So everything very orderly.
And shown very well in at the site, and of course in your book.
Thank you. And it's lovely because
it is beautiful.
The German gardens in particular, the early ones, it was tradition to mix vegetables and herbs and flowers in the same bed often. So it becomes this beautiful, almost quilt-like, you know, mm-hmm. Pattern, just beautiful. And then if you have a moment to sit on the porch and just admire the view of the garden, it's really kind of lovely.
Bill in Madison, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Yes,
I was wondering about the use by the Germans of savory. Both winter and summer savory, because both my wife and my families came from Germany in the 1840s, and they always called it Bohnenkraut.
Right.
They used it mostly on beans and things like that. But was it something they brought with them, or was it something they picked up along the way?
That was something they had known in their homeland. So they, the Bohnenkraut certainly was traditional German seasoning, and we see it more strongly associated with the Germans than the other ethnic groups. And you're right, both summer and winter, and are still used today, of course, as versatile as black pepper. So you could use it, soups and stews and all sorts of seasonings. And the tradition with beans is continues to this day as well.
Hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Bill, for calling. And turn to Peter in Centerville next. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call
today.
When I was young, I spent summers with my grandmother, who was born in 1893 at a place in the country. And we ate almost as many weeds out of her garden as we did vegetables. If your guest would comment a little bit. And then I have a question also. Where did Jerusalem artichokes come from? We had a patch of Jerusalem artichokes that came back every year, and they're a tuber, and they steam up, and they taste like artichoke hearts. But we used to eat purslane and lamb's quarters and stinging nettles when my grandmother and I were living together out in the country.
And what ethnic background was your grandmother?
She was kind of Pennsylvania Dutch, married into some New York Yankees.
Very nice, very nice. Yes, weeds have always existed, and we still grow a lot of the same weeds that were done, that our ancestors were growing. And sure enough, a lot of them are edible, and a lot of them are healthful. So really nice to be able to, if you feel the need to clean them out of your garden, nice to be able to put them into the salad or into the soup pot, a really good idea. And what was your other...
Just a comment on Jerusalem artichokes. Yeah. Do you know anything about where they came from?
Right. I believe the Jerusalem artichokes came with the Yankees. And you're right that they are a plant that once planted, they are perennial and they stick with you a long time. So I would advise when you plant a tuber, put it someplace that you can enjoy it forever. And if you are looking to keep it limited, I would suggest don't ever rototill it, because every little piece makes a new plant. So it's
all right.
Wonderful. The flavor is great. They produce almost like a sunflower-like blossom late in the summer, and they're very attractive. And keep cooking with them. They're good.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Jeff in Waukesha, your turn now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. You know, out at Old World, Wisconsin, they've got wood stoves in every building. I'm wondering if the wood ash actually makes a halfway decent fertilizer, or maybe the creosote wood.
We generally don't use the wood ash in the gardens. Sometimes it's added to the compost piles, but generally not. I'm more apt to tap into the farm staff and ask them for their composted manure. We run compost piles. We also do, they have manure piles that they age off-site for us so that I have access to those after a year or two. We generally don't mix the wood ash in any great quantities.
It fouls up the... You have to be really careful about how much you put down. That's for sure.
That's right. And we do make lye soap out there, so sometimes the wood ash is used with that. So
there you go. Thanks, Jeff. Lynn in Lake Forest, on to you now. Hi, Lynn.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call, Larry and Marcia. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
I'm calling because I understand that my great-grandparents, who came from Germany, brought peony plants over here. And I have some of the descendants in my yard, and I'm wondering if there's any information about the type or variety. And frankly, I must say that on my mother's side, both sets of her grandparents were from Germany, but one was from the area of Koblenz in southwest Germany, and the other from the exact opposite end, up around Stettin in northeast, what was known as East Pomerania or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, neither one of them had estates where they could grow things. I can't even imagine where they could have, had these plants, but not to mention bringing them over, and they didn't live in where they had a yard available when they got here, which would have been in the middle of the 19th century. I really didn't know that they came from there until my aunt, who was at that time in a nursing home, told me, because I was showing her a picture of how pretty they were when they bloomed. I remember she always had them. And she'd bring them wherever my parents lived. She would bring a peony plant. I never connected anything like that until, of course, it was too late to ask.
And your story is a wonderful example of so many of the early settlers did bring plants with them from their homeland. And peonies were a great example, roses also. When people left home, they weren't sure what they were going to find in the New World. And often they brought cuttings or tubers or slips or roots or whatever piece of plants that they had known from home. And when they had family members follow them or neighbors come after they arrived and settled in America, they often wrote home and said, could you bring some of, you know, whatever that plant was that you were missing from home? Mm-hmm. So a lot of wonderful plants did come in, and women in particular treasured those flowering plants. And if they weren't able to plant them anywhere their first year here, they often kept them potted. And even, you know, the tender ones that we wouldn't even think would be in existence in Wisconsin in the 19th century. Women went to great pains to pot things up and bring them in every single winter so that they could plant them back out in their gardens in the spring.
My goodness.
Yeah.
I can only think of the perseverance of the plants and the people.
Yeah, so much to admire. And it's so good for them to share those with us and then for you to continue that line in your family and with your friends. That's just super.
I wish I had known earlier when I could have asked some, you know,
more questions.
Yeah. Right. I think we've all have that feeling. Yeah.
I'm not alone.
Right. No, you're not, Lynn. Thank you very much. You'll enjoy the book, by the way.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Great call. Well, they're all good calls. George in the town of Sandrock. Your turn. Hi, George.
Good morning. I hope I don't fade out. I'm in the middle of the woods on an antenna. But I have a land that's an old homestead, and chickens and cows and all that and pigs. And they had a garden, and what's left over is some tiger lilies and some. And I wondered if that would be different from modern-day species of the same thing.
Ah.
You're talking about your lilies, the tiger lilies that you found?
Yeah, they're from, I would imagine they were planted in the 30s. That's when they homesteaded here, and they've been left over. There's about a half a dozen of them come up every year.
Yeah, nice. And there are many, many different varieties, and of course a lot have been cultivated, but I would think they probably date back pretty far. You could...
Certainly. I'm miles from any, I don't know how far bees pollinate, but I'm miles from any civilization.
Okay, then you have a really good chance that they're really nice old plants, and how nice that you would hang on to them.
You should take a photograph of them at some point. You probably are. Are you hooked up to the internet back there?
No, I don't have electricity, so I'm more or less on solar power.
Ah, well, there you go. I was just saying, when they're in bloom, if you take a photo, and then if you're visiting a place like Old World Wisconsin, or even if you're in town at your extension office, your UW extension office, one of the master gardeners or one of our hort specialists could probably take a look at it and say, you know, I've never seen that before. Marcia, am I on the right track here?
Yeah, I definitely think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Right.
It interested me, and I got a good agricultural agent in Hurley, but also the vinca that covered about an acre now.
The vinca?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
So that's gotten comfortable on the lamp.
This definitely has. George, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, boy. Tom in Kimberly, we turn to you next. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I was in Old World, Wisconsin on Saturday. And going through the German section, I was very surprised to see nasturtium. And the interpreter there said that, yes, that is a plant that they would grow. How would they use it?
Nasturtiums were categorized with vegetables early on, so that it's not a modern take on them to think that you can add them to salads. that it was known that the leaves and the flowers could be eaten, and that the young seed pods as well as the mature buds, flower buds on the plant could be pickled and used as a substitute for capers. So they've been an edible plant for a long, long time, and that's not something we've invented.
Mm-hmm. Judith uses them in her salad.
Yep.
Yeah. I do, too, and I'm making vinegar out of them this year.
Oh, yeah, very tasty. And you can do sort of a Worcestershire sauce substitute using nasturtiums. It's wonderful.
The other thing that I saw that surprised me also in the German section was dried rhubarb. How was that used?
Well, generally, we're looking for lots of ways of preserving the various produce from the garden, and drying is one of the ways. And rhubarb dries down to, as you saw, looks like little sticks or little bones that we
yeah.
Hang on strings. And generally, when that's reconstituted, we sort of simmer it in water, and it then becomes good sauce-making material. You know, it loses its texture, so that it's not very good for pie, but it makes great sauce once it's come back. So, and you can make jam out of it, of course, as well. But yeah, isn't it fun to look at that stuff dangling and wonder what that is?
Yeah, that's exactly my reaction.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We have quite a few emails and so forth here from Shivani. Wondering, we mentioned the garden engine. Could you describe it and please talk about how it works? It looks like it might be something I'd be able to make, or maybe.
Oh yeah, you certainly could make it. It sort of looks like a garden cart with two mm-hmm. wheels. It's a wooden box on the two wheels, and then it's got a couple of legs so that you can let it sit and balance. Has handles mm-hmm. like a wheelbarrow. Ours has a lid that flips open for filling, and ours was they ranged historically their gallonage or their size ranged in different amounts. We've settled on a 40-gallon capacity because that's something that I can push, it's very cool. And then it just has a crank pump, kind of like the old fire engines that you hand crank. Suction then pulls the water up and shoots. And if you're really good, you can aim it up high. You can was used traditionally to put out fires and sometimes to spray orchards with chemicals when people were doing that. We figure we can wash windows. Often we just shoot it up in the air and see how high we can, you know, how far we can send it. But I think if you take a look at the pictures in the book, we have a historic image.
Very good pictures.
And then also a modern image. And then I would invite you to come out and take a look at the real thing that we have in use at the museum.
And we have a Facebook question. What plants were grown in Wisconsin gardens just for their fragrance or blossoms?
Oh, many, many, many. And you've hit me on one of my my favorite aspects of the gardens. To me, fragrance can be enough. There's so many beautiful things. There are herbs that bloom. There are also flowers that have fragrance. So certainly lots of roses, things like mignonette, which gives off a fragrance into the air, the dianthus family, so pinks, and a carnation, all that that group of plants. It's true that a lot of flowering plants don't give fragrance off just without, you know, getting right up close and sniffing them. But we also grow a lot of herbs that are fragrant for petting and sniffing. So, you know, lemon-scented plants, scented geraniums and that sort of thing. There are so many, and I would invite you to come out mid and late summer to visit the gardens and to see the really wide selection of things that we do grow. So, you know, we have peonies and we have roses and we have Sweet William and irises and, you know, just so many different things that I'd love for you to come out and see them.
And an email from Bill. Do all old world gardens come from the old world? It's my understanding that tomatoes cooked in Italy came from South America and then came back to ethnic areas of the U.S. Same, I think, with potatoes. Are there others?
Yeah, you're right on. And all the squashes and cucumbers. And there are a lot of New World crops that then were taken back to the Old World and then brought back to the New World or met in the New World when people came here. So we Yeah, we have a wonderful variety of plant material that we have access to, and it's really neat to trace back the roots of those plants.
Frank in Green Bay says, my wife's family moved from Syria to the Ironwood Hurley area of the state. How did people moving from warmer places manage with adapting their usual garden plants?
Huh. Well, they did a lot of trial and error and found that a lot of things just didn't make it. Probably paid more attention to what successful neighbors were growing in their gardens and learned to lean over the fence and talk to the neighbors, I would think. So a lot of the things that might have been grown in Syria would not survive a Wisconsin winter, but certainly the annuals, the seeds could be collected. Goodness knows we have wicked hot enough summers so many years that a lot of those crops can be grown. Just a matter of finding which ones work and hopefully then adding to it.
Well, we didn't really touch on, you mentioned medicinals, but that was a part of the gardens too.
Especially early on.
Yeah,
right.
Especially early on.
Right, because as the years went by, more and more patent medicines became available and people grew less and less in their gardens. But the stronger their ethnic connection to their family background, often they continued the traditional remedies.
Well, Marcia, I tell you, it has been a real joy to have you with us today. I've learned a lot, and I just loved your book.
Thank you so much.
It's a treasure, and I know a lot of people are going to be interested in reading it and looking at those wonderful photographs. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Marcia Carmichael, historical gardener at the Old World, Wisconsin. And she's done a lot of fabulous work with the gardens, and it's reflected in the book that she's put out. It's called Putting Down Roots, Gardening Insights from Wisconsin's Early Settlers, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Great to have her along, and hope we get a chance to talk with her again. Tomorrow we'll talk astronomy with Paul Kinzer, and then a look at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Stay with us.